You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Eight ten on a Monday. Joining me, as he does every couple weeks, from SoftRep, one of their senior writers, former Marine, Sergeant type, Alex Hollings. Alex, good morning. June, this is the first show in the third year of All Marine Radio, so welcome to our happy birthday show.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations. That's fantastic.
No, third year, probably not, but let's give it a shot anyway. What the hell? And no kidding, still doing it. So, first of all, I got a couple, one question for you, and then I got a text message before you came on, so I'll ask you that. First of all, your daughter, how old is she? And
she just turned 6 months old, and she's already going on like 16, man. She barely needs me anymore. She's holding her own bottle. She just woke up with teeth yesterday. This kid, I'm already freaking out about how fast she's growing up. It's
you
crazy.
You know what? There's major strides that a child makes. One is holding their own bottle. Okay. And then two is not needing a diaper anymore. Two huge gates that a kid has. It's like, because when they can hold their own bottle, that means you are a little bit emancipated to go maneuver around the battle space. Until then, you're kind of screwed sitting next to them. Like, would you just, and then when they start screwing with the bottle, like initially you stick it in and they're like all business. And then maybe a little bit later or two, then they start looking around. You're like, no, that's not, I'm not going to sit here for 20 minutes while you play games with this. Okay. Drink it now.
This is literally what she's doing now. The bottle has become a toy, but not just a toy, but a squirt gun.
Oh.
That's what she's done now, is she's gotten really good at just covering herself
nice.
In formula or breast milk. So she can hold her own bottle, but you still have to give her direct supervision, not because she can't handle it, but just because she wants to mess with you. You know?
Nice. Like,
she's definitely my wife's daughter. You know, she's a troublemaker for sure.
The all right. Here's the text message question was this. Matt, could you ask Alice about building muscle after 50?
Absolutely. You know, this is the big hurdle that you run into once you hit, like, I want to say 50, but honestly, it sets in earlier for some people as young as 35. But your testosterone levels start to drop the older that you get, you know? I mean,
right.
It's the same thing that happens to women. It's why women enter menopause, because their hormonal balance gets out of whack the older we get. You know, we're all village elders now. The way that we were built, we were supposed to die triumphantly in battle at age, like, 28. And if you make it past that, you just, like, hang out in the teepee and smoke the peace pipe and tell people about your old stories. You know, so it's an uphill battle, but it gets steeper the older you get, you know? There's a couple of things that you can do. One of them is to just make sure you're making healthy choices, but work harder. As awful as it sounds, but you got to push a little bit harder to get that same bit of result out of your body that you used to be able to do. But there's also a lot of dietary things out there that can help you either limit your estrogen production, because we all produce estrogen just like we do testosterone.
Speak for yourself.
And if you limit,
speak for yourself, bro.
So if you can limit your estrogen production, you know, it can help maintain that balance. There's a lot of homeopathic and supplement crap.
Whoa,
out there.
Hey, easy with the homeopathic stuff, okay? What are we talking about here?
We're talking about, like, dirt and plants.
Oh, okay.
That don't actually work, but someone will tell you.
I wasn't sure where we're
tell you.
I wasn't sure where we were going.
Okay, yeah. No. I don't support purchasing these things. But there's a million products out there that'll tell you it'll increase your testosterone levels.
Yeah.
They won't. You know?
They won't?
I mean, you can increase your testosterone levels via steroids, anabolic steroids, which are testosterone. But other than that,
Is that wrong?
Getting a prescription for testosterone, you're not going to be able to offset that reduction in testosterone production.
Why?
There might be some products out there
you,
that might.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question about that. So why wouldn't men get hormone therapy? I think women get it. Why?
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't men get testosterone replaced? Because it is a good thing for men, yes?
You know, a lot of men do. It's much more of a fad thing to do out in, like, Hollywood.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But a lot of these guys that you see doing steroids, even in their 30s, the way they do it is very similar to the way that you go get your medical marijuana card in a place like California. So you go to a doctor who specializes in this stuff. And by specializes, I mean makes a living selling steroids. And you go there and you fill out your piece of paper that says, oh, these are my symptoms, you know, and what you do is you qualify your symptoms to suit someone who's got a testosterone deficiency. Then this doctor comes and looks at it and goes, yeah, it looks to me like you've got a testosterone deficiency. We're going to prescribe you these anabolic steroids. There's real benefits to doing steroids this way. Number one, it's prescribed to you, so it's a controlled substance. It's not like something some guy made in his garage. But number two, your doctor will help you. The threat of steroids that people are always worried about are really when you come off of anabolic steroids and you get pimples, you get boobs because your hormone balance is all screwed up.
Yeah, see, I'm not talking about that, though, Alex. I'm just talking about you have, let's just say that medically, it's a good, it's medically good to keep your testosterone level somewhere between where you were between the ages of, let's just say, 30 and 35. That's good for you. It keeps your bone density good. It keeps your muscle density good, your muscle mass good, right? And so that medically is not a bad thing to do. I've thought about it, like, well.
I would argue medically I agree with you. I'm sure that there are doctors out there who will tell you, you know, that there are risks associated with any kind of treatment.
Right.
In my opinion, yeah, I'm all about it, man. Shoot me up. I mean.
Yeah, well, I just think that wouldn't it make sense that if you're losing testosterone at an accelerated rate, that, and again, I'm not talking about doing anabolic steroids. I'm just talking about maintaining the ecosystem, and testosterone is part of that. But it seems like you can't do that except illegally, and I don't really understand it.
Practical application, it wouldn't be that different than these guys who are being prescribed steroids for the sake of getting bigger. It would just be the responsible and appropriate use of that same practice.
I agree.
You know, but there are definitely doctors out there. There are treatment options out there. Probably not going to be covered by insurance. You know, you got to be willing to spend the money. I'd imagine it isn't inexpensive. You know, and find a doctor who was willing to do it out here in the woods of Georgia. You know, I'm lucky if my doctor knows what antidepressants are, let alone, you know, anabolic treatments. You've got to find someone qualified, and you've got to find someone willing, and you've got to have the money in your hands. But no, it's absolutely a feasible option.
Okay. All right. So is there a reason why we want, do that, medically?
Lord knows there might be. I mean, there may be something. It could exacerbate other, you know, health problems that you might have as you get older.
Okay.
I'm not a doctor. I couldn't tell you for sure. But I will tell you that if I find a doctor who's willing to give me the needle, hell, I'll take it now, man. I might only be in my 30s, but I could use any help I can get.
Well, I think that the people that have a lot of money go to doctors. And let me tell you, I lived in West Los Angeles, and I have a friend who worked for a plastic surgeon, okay? But that's not how this plastic surgeon advertises her skills. She advertises her skills as a life enhancement specialist, right? And so, when you gain a reputation of working with people in the entertainment business, right? You're good with you're good with your scalpel, and you're also not afraid to prescribe certain medications. And so it goes. And so some of the people, and again, I'm not talking about looking like something grotesque. I'm just talking about being able to maintain, you know, like Hollings, he doesn't need much, okay? He doesn't need much, but his testosterone, he's losing at about 1% a year. And so we'll just prescribe for him this low dose of testosterone so he can maintain it. We'll review it when he comes in for his annual checkup because, you know, we want him to continue to be fit and having testosterone in your body for men is a good thing.
Absolutely. You know, and one thing that you really need to think about when you consider this is the doctor that you're talking to. Because right. I'd argue, and this is without being a doctor myself, Lord knows, but I would argue that the difference between being the guy that's just supplementing your testosterone in a way to compensate for your natural, you know, reduction in production, and being the Sylvester Stallone, I mean, HGH is a naturally occurring, you know, chemical within your body. He just blows himself up with it, right? The difference between being a Stallone and being the guy who's just compensating for his natural regression is really all about the dosage and the way you implement the treatment. You know what I mean? You don't have to go all the way out to the Sylvester Stallone, you know, range, you know, that side of the spectrum in order to receive this kind of treatment. Again, though, I'm not a doctor. This is really something you need to talk to your doctor about. But I would argue, you know, I think that what we're going to see is more and more of this. We're going to see more and more medical science transferring out of the treating you for a condition territory and migrating into the treating you for a perceived condition. You know, right. I mean, just like Invisalign braces or breast implants or testosterone injection. If you can do it in a safe enough manner, I don't have any problem with it.
Well, and let me just, and I say that to say this. I say that not to, you know, that not so, because I want to see Alex rolling around South Padre Island in his Speedo anytime soon. I say that because a friend of mine who's a trainer in Los Angeles, our sons play hockey together, and he's an awesome guy. His name's Alan, and he looks like a Hispanic gangbanger, right? He rolls up. He's got a pair of like overall jeans on with the chain from his, you know, from his belt to his wallet. Right, he's got the flannel shirt on buttoned all the way up, and he looks like he looks angry. He's the nicest computer network programmer you've ever met in your life, and he's rocked up. So he and I are talking, and he said, "You know," and this is years ago. This might be 6-7 years ago. He said, "You know what amazes me, Mike?" And I don't know where I've been, but I've been lifting, you know, just regularly. And he asked me, he said, "Do you take anything, any supplements?" And I said, "No." He goes, "You must be holding on to your steroid pretty good." And I said, "Like, I don't even know what you're talking about, man." He said, "No." He said, "Look, you look fit." And, you know, and I was in my 50s, and he said, "You know, Mike, testosterone is like a wonder drug."
It is.
He said, "As long as you have a fair amount of it," he said, "I train guys in their 70s and one in his 80s. And if he will consistently train, that drug will build muscle." He said, "It's amazing. Absolutely, positively, one of the most amazing drugs on the planet because of what it does." Now, when you say build muscle, I'm not talking about, like, for me, I'm not a,
you're not the power lifter type.
I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm a part runner. I'm a part cyclist, and but I'm not a skinny all rep guy. You know, I kind of come, you know, 235, 225. You know, up to there in terms of my bench. So I mean, that's not a whole lot.
That's, honestly, that's solid. That's really good.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean,
when
you're 60,
consider your own weight. Also that, but consider your weight as well. You know, I mean, to be honest, I'm a weightlifting guy because it's where my interests lie, not necessarily because it makes me the most functional, right? But whenever I work out with somebody, they're always like, "Yeah, well, you can bench press, you know, this much weight, and I can only bench press this much weight." That doesn't matter. You know, when we're talking about functional strength, me being able to one rep max 360 serves almost no purpose in the real world.
Right.
There's never a scenario in which that actually comes in handy.
No, that's not
other
true.
Than if somebody asks me what I can bench at the bar.
No, it's not you true. Know? You may roll. You may have to move a car off somebody one day. One rep.
You know, if I have to move a car off somebody, that's more of a deadlift, though. I mean, unless I'm underneath
true.
It and the
true.
Car only weighs 350 pounds, I'm still screwed. You know. So I really think that when you say, you know, my bench goes up to 235, don't discount that as though that's not an accomplishment. That's fantastic.
No. Look, I'm proud of it, but I, in explaining when you talk about building muscle mass, you know, this is just my experience, and I would say I'm above average physically in terms of I've pretty much done anything I want. Wanted to physically most of my life, and except for a knee injury that screwed my running up a little bit, I've been pretty fortunate in terms of being able to do that kind of stuff. And but as I've gotten older, I've gotten good advice from doctors. One of them said, "Hey, can I give you some advice?" And I said, "Yeah." And this is when I came back into the Marine Corps. He said, "You're more fit than most of these guys in here, and you're older than them by somewhere between 15 and 20 years." And I said, "What's your point?" And he looked at me and goes, "You're a Marine, aren't you?" I said, "Maybe." "Maybe? Why, are we going to make fun now?" He said, "No, no." He said, "Look, I could close my eyes and I could tell you what you are. You've been probably athletic most of your life. When you feel pain, you just ignore it. You just keep going." He said, "You need to pay attention to pain as you get older. Because the recovery time is longer, the longer it takes
Absolutely.
You to recover, the more your body atrophies, and then you got
to
go start."
And honestly, the longer it takes to recover, the less likely you are to come back to it.
Right.
You know, as you get older, it's easier and easier for things to become just the way they are from now on.
Right.
Right? When you're young, when you're in your teens and your 20s and your early 30s even, you know, like, you can start new adventures and move in that direction. Now, you can always start new adventures at any point in your life, but it's really easy when you're 20 to always have the energy to go work out. Once you're older, it's discipline that'll make you go work out, not motivation.
Right.
Motivation is fleeting. Motivation will go away the minute you're a little tuckered out, the minute you had a bad day at work. Motivation's going to go away, and you're going to want a quarter pounder instead. Discipline, however, will get your ass in the gym.
Right.
You know, and discipline is what we've got to rely on as we get older. But when you get hurt, you know, Lord knows, I've had plenty of surgeries. And when you get hurt, you end up on the couch, you know, for 6 weeks, 8 weeks sometimes. It's really hard to come back to the gym after 8 weeks of doing nothing. It's even harder to come back to the gym after 8 weeks of doing nothing at 60. You know, so you have to take these injuries into account because, you know, I'm in my 30s. When I get hurt bad enough that I need to take a week or two off from the gym, fortunately, I haven't had any real bad injuries, you know, in the last 2 years. But if I need to take a few weeks off from the gym, the first day is kind of rough, and then it's real easy to take time off, man. I can talk myself out of working out any day of the week.
Let me ask you this. Do you build in, like, weeks off and things like that?
You know, I used to. Now, it's all kind of become a natural progression for me because I end up taking time off unintentionally because I'm traveling for work or personal reasons or something crazy happens with the kid. I haven't had the need because instead I'm always struggling to find time to do it lately, you know. But when I was younger, absolutely. I would be like, I wouldn't take time off completely, but I would change my workouts up completely. I'm going to do nothing but cardio for the next 2 weeks because I got to get out of the gym.
Got it.
If anything, just to clear my headspace, you know? But keeping your body guessing is a good thing. But to get back to that building muscle, one more tip I'll give you. The majority of the testosterone stores in your body are in your glutes and your thighs. So if you can activate those muscle groups regularly, you're going to release more of that testosterone out into your body and you're going to get progress faster. People are always surprised when I tell them, but the fastest way to make your chest and your arms bigger is to work legs as well. If you ignore your legs, you're going to slow everything down. Your legs are holding most of that testosterone, and as we're talking about, it's a great, great chemical. Let as much of that out as you can. So try to activate your thighs, your butt, do lunges, do squats. If you've got back or knee injuries that you've got to contend with, take them into account. You know what I mean? I think most of us do, especially as we get older. So don't throw a ton of weight on the bar. You can do bodyweight squats and really activate your glutes. But I would really encourage making sure you don't skip leg day, especially as you get older, because that's where most of that testosterone is stored.
All right, let's switch gears. We could talk about serious stuff, and nobody will care. But if we talk about UFOs, okay, the place goes hysterical, okay? So you recently have written a piece about UFOs and the United States Navy, okay? So I want to cover that, and I also I want to get your thoughts on something that I've spoken about a lot since it happened, and that is the collision of the McCain, which is very different from the collision of the Fitzgerald. And you've written about that. You wrote about that last week. So we've got 30 minutes or so. So we're going to talk both of those things, which is going to require some verbal discipline on your part, which I know is something you're not used to. So first of all, talk about the Navy and UFOs.
I got to jump in right off the bat. And you said we could talk about serious stuff, but instead we're going to talk about UFOs.
UFOs are serious?
I disagree.
I'm
not saying that they're aliens. I don't really buy the idea that we've got aliens visiting us here. I mean, some of these things do sound crazy. However, I think that it's absolutely integral to our national defense that we take sightings of weird shit in the sky seriously. You know, we're no longer living in a world where the United States has got a monopoly on the advanced technology of war. We've been devoting all our money to fighting, you know, to insurgency warfare for the last 2 decades. And while we've been doing that, China and Russia don't have to spend as much as us to catch up because they're not fighting these wars. So instead, all they need to do, like, you know, Russia barely even has a functional drone program because it's not that important to them. They're not fighting wars that they need them. Instead, they're focusing their money on, admittedly, some ludicrous missile platforms and things like that. But as Russia and China continue to advance, and we continue to advance, we've got to be keeping our eyes out for aircraft that might be better than what we've got. That's the reason why I really think, again, like, the Pentagon's Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program, or whatever they called it, was a really important endeavor. Not because I'm worried about aliens coming and mutilating our cows, but I'm worried about advanced drone technology. I'm worried about advanced reconnaissance technology. I'm worried about the threat that airborne, you know, whatever the heck these things are, whether they're drones or manned aircraft or something else entirely, I worry that eventually or currently they could pose a threat. Now, all of that said, 99 out of 100 times you see a UFO reporting, it is either A, new drone technology or a modified commercial drone, or B, a misidentified military aircraft.
Okay.
But civilians tend to see military aircraft and think UFO because they don't travel like commercial air traffic. You know, they take like crazy turns, they fly low, they sound different than an airliner flying overhead might. At night, you know, I live right near Dahlonega, where the Rangers train, Blackhawks will fly over my house at night all the time. And my wife and I, who have seen these helicopters a million times, not just living here, but, you know, throughout most of our adult lives, every once in a while we're still like, man, what the hell is that thing over there? You know, because it can be tough to identify these things. And if us, with a great deal of experience seeing these helicopters, can do that, anybody can. You know?
Well, and so let me tell you, sometimes they play with special toys, those guys. Do you remember the helicopter?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you remember the Buck Rogers helicopter that got smashed up in the Bin Laden raid?
And absolutely. It looked a lot like the Comanche that had been discontinued, and it turned out it was a stealth Blackhawk. Absolutely.
Right.
So when you see these things, it's really a great example was late last year, there was a whole formation of C-17s and C-130s that were all heading out west for a big Air Force weapons operation, you know, a training exercise. In the middle of the night, in a big open sky, you see 30 C-17s flying in a massive formation, flying across the sky. Now, a C-17, if you're not familiar, is a huge goddamn airplane. You see 30 of those fly by, you're going to think something crazy is going on. If you don't think that's a UFO, you're even more scared, you know? So these things will pop up on Twitter, and I've got Google alerts and data miner alerts and stuff for these UFO sightings. They'll right. pop up, and you can go to commercial traffic, air traffic websites, and you can see, oh, no, these are all American military aircraft flying out to the Southwest. And you can watch them go, but you can watch the Twitter, oh, my God, there's a UFO over Nevada, things pop up as they cross. You know, supposedly these are military aircraft. But that's why it's so interesting when it's military people reporting the UFO sighting. You know, so the one that I wrote about just recently was the USS Nimitz, which is, you know, the namesake for the Nimitz-class carriers. It was the Nimitz carrier group off the coast of Southern California back in 2004. You know, they were just doing regular pre-deployment workups, doing some training. I think it was like 250 miles off the coast of California. When over a six-day span of time, they kept getting these radar signatures that would first pop up, I think it was either 60,000 or 80,000 feet at the ceiling of their aircraft tracking radar. These things would pop up and then rapidly drop down to like 20,000 feet, stay stationary. Drop down to just above the surface of the water, stay stationary. They tracked these over like 2 or 3 days. At one point, they had a few F-18s in the air, F-18s in the air, that were doing a training operation. They asked them to redirect to go and intercept this radar signature. Commander Fravor, I don't know the name of the other pilot offhand, actually saw this thing. He said it looked like a tic-tac. It had no wings. It had no control surfaces. It had no jet plume. It was just sitting there, you know, 50 feet above the water. It seemed to respond to their presence as they were about a mile away from it and about 3,000 feet above it.
Okay, and this is the video. This is the video that people can watch, right? And hear them talking.
This is the video of this intercept. Right. Absolutely. So the video came out a while ago. Right. But so this 13-page report was released by Senator Harry Reid's office. And then you have to bear in mind.
Oh, wait a minute. He was hooking up one of his buddies with this UFO shit, right?
So Harry Reid was indeed the guy who originally tried to get this program funded, and it was with Bigelow Aerospace Industries. There's still contracts with NASA. Bigelow, who owns the Skywalker Ranch, for any tinfoil hat wearers out there, they'll be familiar with Skywalker Ranch. This guy really does believe in aliens, or at least he really sells the idea that he really believes in aliens, but he's also a very competent aerospace contractor. I would argue this, it sounds to me like a little bit of good old boy hookup. However, other people, Luis Elizondo, who ran the program, he doesn't seem to treat it that way. His argument was, if anything, that it was underfunded, because funding was cut off in 2012, but the program continued throughout. At any rate, so Harry Reid's got a conflict of interest, if you ask me. So yeah, I want to give you a grain of salt. This report was released by Harry Reid's office, and it's in Harry Reid's best interest to make it look like there's a reason why he spent our $22 million. You know, so grain of salt with anything you get from this. But the report shows that these sightings happened over in of a six-day period. Two aircraft actually got visual confirmation of one of these tic-tac-shaped things behaving in such a weird way. Another aircraft saw a weird disturbance on the surface of the water that made it look like there was something submerged just below the water. You know, out in the middle of the ocean, waves were breaking on something that he couldn't see. So the nuclear attack sub that was in the carrier group confirmed that there were no sonar signatures in the area, and that's about the end of that. In another incident, two Super Hornets, well, Commander Fravor and another Hornet pilot, both saw the craft, and they tried to close with it close enough to get a really good look at it. This is the part that was interesting to me. The aircraft darted off. So they were like, all right, well, let's regroup at our cap, which is, you know, which was effectively their starting point, or their regroup point. So they turned to go head back to their cap point, which was 60 nautical miles away, and they got a call from their cruiser and the battle group saying, we just tracked this thing on radar. It's back at your cap. Where you're headed now? Which leads me to believe that either, A, this is like a whole lot of, like, weird electronic issue, like electronic warfare, giving us some false leads in our equipment, or maybe it's monitoring communications. I don't know what the hell this thing is, man. To be honest with you, this is the most befuddling UFO case I've come across, because all the witnesses seem reliable, they seem reasonable, you know, they're professional aviators, they're the bridge crew of a cruiser, And the things that this thing was able to do doesn't sound like any experimental drone to me. It doesn't sound like a reconnaissance aircraft or a glint on your windshield or swamp gas. I love to poo-poo UFO sightings. That's my favorite thing to do. I love to go, that's a drone, man. Come on.
But?
This one's weird. I don't know what to tell you this one was.
Now you're going to be that guy.
Now I'm that guy. You know, normally I love to go on, like, anybody who will let me tell you why these things aren't aliens, I like
right.
to, you know,
right.
let me be that guy. This one's got me befuddled. I still don't buy aliens.
But.
I don't know what the hell this thing is.
Okay. All right. So, but your message in writing this is we need, but people like me, and you include yourself in this group, need to stop being so skeptical and dismissive of this, because there are technologies out there that will come at us in irregular forms, and we need to be open to the idea that other nations are beginning to exploit these technologies.
That's my genuine belief. My genuine okay. belief is not that there's a threat posed by ET. You know, my real belief is that if we write all of these sightings off offhand just because it sounds fantastic,
yeah.
we're going to end up missing important things, you know? And especially when we're talking about coastal defense, when we're talking about 250 miles off of our west coast, that's an area of the world that I'd like us to be especially careful about, especially when it comes to crazy aircraft. When we're talking about the age of hypersonic missile platforms and anti-ship warfare, when something crazy is going on around one of our carrier strike groups for days, we're not able to intercept it, we're not able to explain it, that's disconcerting to me, not because I'm worried about aliens, but because our carrier strike groups are our largest and most effective means of exerting force elsewhere in the world. So if our defenses around one of those carrier strike groups can't figure out what's going on, that's a concern for me. You know?
Okay, email question. Hey, Mac, always interesting when Alex comes on. Has he written anything about that event in eastern Syria where the soft guys whacked somewhere between 200 and 500 Russians, depending on who you read? Have you written anything about that?
I have, but there's actually a better piece written by one of my coworkers named Kurt Trotter, who's a... He was a U.S. Marine, ended up leaving and fighting with the Peshmerga after he got out. He went and fought ISIS in Iraq. And then from there, just kind of like, you know how that thing tends to go, at least so it seems. You know, he went and fought with the Peshmerga, realized being a mercenary was kind of a good gig for him, and ended up going elsewhere. But Kurt's got first-hand experience fighting with Russian mercenaries, I would call them. I think that they're uniformed Russian troops. I don't think maybe not in uniform, but
right.
I think that this is
the same
layer of deniability.
Yeah, it's what they did they did in the Crimea. It's what they've done in
exactly.
the Ukraine, right? Take your patches off.
Absolutely. Now, so Kurt wrote a better piece on it, but it's a really, really interesting story. We're talking about a force of, depending on who you ask, between 200 and 400 Russian mercenaries, which according to the Russian government have no ties to the Russian government,
of course not.
We've got comm records showing that they were in communication with Kremlin officials throughout the engagement.
Okay, let me ask you this. Let me see if you can answer this Russian IQ question. How do you know Russians are lying?
They're talking.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
100%. We're on the same page, man. Russia is, they're not that good at this. People mistake being successful and being good. Those are different categories when it comes to disinformation. Because there's a lot of ways you can go about it. Russia's way is the shotgun method. They just keep throwing shit at you. Enough different stuff all the time. That every different facet of the internet is going to pick up on their own conspiracy theory and run with it. You know, it's the same reason why you saw lots of red-blooded Americans shouting and hooting and hollering that Donald Trump staged this entire chemical weapons attack just so that he could launch some missiles at Syria. It was an ineffectual attack that we launched on Syria. We still didn't really do anything to them. Everything about that wasn't in our best interest, except that our hand was kind of forced. We needed to do something. That's obvious, but the Russian line, the narrative was, there was no chemical attack. America is faking this. And people love a conspiracy, man. People love something. They want to believe that there's more to what's going on than playground politics. And unfortunately, what we're getting is a lot of playground politics. And Russia is so good at that. Because they don't have a moral compass. Now, I'm not saying Russian people. I'm sure there are good Russian people. But the Russian government's a bad guy.
Oh, my God. It's ridiculous. It's almost like a bad Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon, right? You know, the Russian.
It really is.
It's just like so. And you know what? What I don't understand, Alex, is it's not, certainly not in the best interest of the Russian people, because what's in the best interest of the Russian people is to economically integrate with Europe.
Absolutely.
Right? And try to get their economy, and again, you and I have talked about this before, but beyond Canada's economy, which is stunning when you hear that. What? Yeah. Russia's economy,
you know,
is smaller than Canada's.
They're worried about, you know, like World War III and Russia being this looming threat. China, in my opinion, is the looming threat. Russia's got a prostitution-based economy.
Looming?
You know, they can't afford, I mean, they've got one aircraft carrier, and they can't afford to keep it in the water. It travels everywhere with a tugboat. You know? Now, don't get me wrong. Russia does have some capable and viable weapon systems.
But they're faking it. They're faking it, though.
Absolutely. It's a bunch, you know, every time you hear about this new Russian missile that just came out,
right,
I can almost guarantee you it's actually a Soviet-era program that's just been on the shelf until they could save up enough pennies to pay for it.
Right.
It's still nothing. You know, this a great example being Putin's nuclear-powered cruise missile. It's this missile that he touted as having a nearly infinite, you know, fuel supply. It can stay airborne continuously, which will help it maneuver around air defenses, and it's going to be such a huge deal. Times they can't get the damn thing to fly. Eventually, though, they will. They'll get it to fly. And the reason why I know this is because we did it in the 1950s. You know, we had nuclear propulsion systems on missiles and aircraft that we were testing as far back as, like, 53. The reason why we didn't follow through with it is because it was a huge environmental risk. You know, not just for the environment itself, but for the people living underneath where you'd have this thing fly. And it didn't, the benefits didn't outweigh the risks. That hasn't changed. You know, they're still trying to get this missile to fly. Eventually, they'll get it to fly. They're throwing all this money at it, and it's not actually going to change anything strategically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a hypersonic platform, that's a legitimate threat. If you can mount a good targeting apparatus on a hypersonic missile, which Russia has some, then you've got a real threat to us.
Right.
I don't give a shit if you've got a big gas tank on one of your cruise missiles.
Yeah, that's not gonna change. Let me tell you, where hypersonic missiles are certainly an issue for the United States is nuclear-tipped hypersonic missiles right now are not defeatable. They will be, though.
Absolutely.
Because this is the evolution of technology, and we will come out, or some nation will come out with something that defeats these things. But a nuclear-tipped hypersonic missile fired at a fixed target, which means a city, that's an issue. Okay. Now, Alex and I have talked about hypersonic missiles against dynamic targets like ships and aircraft and things like that. The first problem is you got to acquire the target. And so
that's a huge hurdle.
That's a huge hurdle for those guys. So it's good to talk to smart people. When you hear this, the gloom and doom of it's a hypersonic missile. Yeah. Talk to smart people and they'll tell you the limited application of that. And there's a window that they have. What are they going to do? Threaten to nuke us off the planet, right? During the 5 years they have this window? Probably not. Okay, probably not.
The big concern I have about these hypersonic platforms is how far behind we are.
Right.
We really got caught with our pants down on this hypersonic.
I think if you're going to take any solace from any of that, I think the Congress recognizes that we're funding that, and nobody can do innovation like the United States can.
That's true, and we're dumping a bunch of money into it. You know, the Air Force General in charge of procurement, I can't remember her name, she recently talked about it really optimistically, you know, saying that, like, we're going to have, you know, functional tests of a hypersonic platform within 2 years. I found that as disheartening, since the DF-21B has been in China's arsenal since 2010. you know, they've had the last 8 years to work on the targeting apparatus for that thing.
Right.
And we're still trying to come up with engines. You know, that's really disconcerting to me. However, another big contract was awarded to Lockheed Martin. Not that they're very good at using money in an efficient manner, but theoretically, they at least have a history of producing platforms that work, you know, except for the F-35 lately. But, you know, I think that what we're going to see is instead of coming up with a really effective defense against hypersonic platforms, what we're going to end up with is a defense that's about as effective as we currently have against supersonic platforms. We talk about our missile defense systems like they're impenetrable. They are not. They're pretty good. You know, I would argue better than Russia's. Russia's are damn near ineffective whatsoever. It's really hard to shoot with a missile. It's like shooting a bullet at a bullet further away than you can see, you know? So we don't have 100% success rate with any of these missile defense systems. But what we do have is a moderately successful set of platforms and a lot of bravado. And that bravado is really what ends up saving us, because nobody wants to actually go out and put these things into use in practical application in a combat zone, because then the whole world's going to see how ineffective they are. Syria, you know, Russia saw that firsthand when Israel went in and blew up a bunch of Russian anti-aircraft, you know, equipment, and they were like, oh, they weren't turned on yet. We weren't ready yet. That's why it didn't work. It didn't work because it doesn't work, man.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I think what we're going to end up seeing is it'll be a bit of an arms race for who can develop the most capable hypersonic platforms the fastest. And it'll end up being like a mutually assured destruction type of thing. The thing that's going to keep us safe is not necessarily going to be our defenses against it, though we'll claim that is. You know, we'll say our defenses can stop it. Don't call our bluff.
Right.
As far as you know, it'll work. And then we're going to develop our own offensive platforms, so it'll be a counter-strike scenario. It'll be a, sure, if you think one of our aircraft carriers, you know, we're going to war, you need to know that we've got the platforms to decimate you in retribution. That's what I think is going to be our safest bet to counter the hypersonic situation. It's really tough to stop a missile going, you know, Mach 6 on a vertical trajectory, falling out of the sky directly onto you.
Right.
None of the apparatus
right now,
that we have
right
in
now,
place right now,
right now
can do that.
Right now. But, okay, but my kids do this thing when they talk, and they'll, especially when they're explaining something. Dad, let me explain this to you, because you think you understand it, and then while they're talking to me, they kind of rotate they kind of rotate sideways, and they bring like the knee closest to me up to their mid stomach and turn a little bit, and then they point to their butt. But you really don't. it's a pretty cool move when you want to make somebody laugh and do something a little bit demeaning.
Now, when you say your kids, do you mean like your kids that are in their 30s and Marine
yes,
officers?
Yes, yes, yes. Dad,
yeah.
Dad, you think you understand, but you really don't. It's like, so, anyway. But we can't conceive of it now, but they're dorky little human beings that we probably didn't hang out with much in high school and college that look at that and go and do this. That's interesting. And then they go in and they get the little mechanical pencil out of their plastic pocket protector. I don't even know if they use that anymore. They probably don't, but they get some version of that, probably electronic now, and they begin to start looking at that problem. And trust me, there's a solution to it, because whenever this kind of shit happens, I don't care if it's an improvement in a tank main gun, I don't care if it's a sabo round, I don't care if it's a toe, there's always a remedy for it, okay? There's always a remedy.
No, and I've got one pitch for you here that I'm actually really excited about. The Naval Strike Missile, it's this Norwegian platform that they've already been fielding for a long time.
Right. The Navy just adopted it, right?
Yes, the Navy did this, and not only that, but they're working on converting it to be fired from the internal weapons phase of an F-35. That's awesome. These missiles only have a range of about 100 miles. So we're not talking about, these are not going to be our competitor for like the DF-21D anti-ship missile. That thing's a friggin' ICBM. You know, I mean, it's about the same size as the fuselage of a Lancer B-1B. It's a huge missile. We're not going to tote those things around on the ship to fire back at China.
We can't?
These are, I mean, we absolutely could. You know, we could be shooting missiles similar to that from missile launch bays on our guided missile cruisers and our Revert class. But what we really need is we need something to conduct anti-ship warfare that isn't 1,000 miles away. As important as that is, that's just like you're saying, targeting becomes a really big limiting factor, especially if we're talking about a situation where we no longer have access to our satellites, which would be likely in the event of a war with China or Russia.
Oh. Right? Which is really interesting. So what takes the place of that? Do we have capable and launching like our own cellular network that we can put up and take down, knowing that it's going to get blasted out of the sky if we leave it there too long?
Air Force right now is trying to fund deploying hardened GPS satellites that would feasibly be more difficult to interfere with, but in my opinion, that's still,
more difficult.
Yeah, we're talking about half measures.
Yeah. Okay,
the ability to deploy short area communications networks. I think that it would be extremely difficult for us to manage global communications without access to our satellites.
I don't know how you do it. Comwire.
Yeah.
Comwire. I read an article that said fiber optic comwire. I was like, what? Yeah, think about it.
On the one hand, I mean, it would be super fast and sort of physically interfering with it. You wouldn't be able to intercept. I don't know how practical that would be. Yeah, I mean, fiber optics has got to be expensive.
I don't know. I don't know. All right, let's switch gears. Switch gears. We got 9 minutes. Commander of the McCain, what was the significance? First of all, does the Navy want these things to go to trial? Because if they do, they show the dysfunction that exists on their bridges on two separate ships that led to the death of 17 sailors in two separate incidents. Talk about what the Navy wants out of this, and talk about the McCain commander, the McCain's commanding officer, Commander Sanchez, who pled guilty to a single charge of negligence.
To be honest with you, so within the writers group at SOFREP, we had a bit of an internal debate about this, because some people saw this as a leader falling on his sword and taking responsibility for something that happened under his command. I don't think that's what happened here. You know, the guy ended up retiring just like he would have. He got a formal letter of reprimand. And I think he ended up being fined something like $6,000.
Yes.
Seven sailors died. You know, you can make a million arguments about how the fault, you know, the watch officer, you know, obviously was at fault, as we discussed earlier. However, ultimately, you know, I mean, he's the commander of the ship. This is ultimately on him. And if the only punishment this guy ends up getting is a piece of paper that says that you screwed up this one time, I have trouble sitting with that and still claiming that the Navy's taking responsibility. Now, maybe what we're seeing here is the Navy acknowledging that there's a systemic issue, like you and I have talked about before. Maybe they're acknowledging that.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, in the case of the McCain, I mean, he was on the bridge. He was running shit. It's not like the Fitzgerald. First of all, the Fitzgerald, they were NJPing the officer of the deck. She got NJP, and then they
repealed it.
Who in their right mind? Can you imagine that you do something that kills seven Marines, and the Marine Corps says,
days confinement, reduction in pay grade.
We're gonna NJP you. Like, what did they just say? Yeah. Did I just hear that right? Who the fuck does that make sense to?
For driving after a curfew, you know, like it's ludicrous. But this is the problem that I really see here is that I think people were like, how could you possibly let this go to NJP? It's obviously got to go to court martial.
Right.
These things go to court martial, and then all of these sailors are walking away with very little in the form of any kind of formal punishment.
Okay,
themselves.
I agree with you in that we don't punish people that do things wrong. Okay, and I'm going to take you to a Marine Corps example. The latest Marine Corps example of this is two different, very different verdicts. The gunny who hazed a recruit that contributed to his alleged suicide was given, was the court The jury recommended that he be in prison for 7 years. He was given 10, okay? The lieutenant colonel, right, who was told by the regimental commander that that gunny should not be leading Marines or anywhere near Marines recruits, he was given the same type of punishment. I want to say he was fined maybe $5,000. He wasn't reduced in rank, and he's allowed to retire. Like,
but then you look at the commander of this ship where 7 sailors died, and he got a letter of reprimand.
It's same thing. He got a fine. So I don't know. What's the message? You, we're going to hold you accountable, but not very much. We're going to end your career, and that's really going to be the worst thing that happens to you. And then there's going to be people that push back and say, well, isn't that enough? I don't know. That my own opinion, when you contribute, and again, when your negligence, okay, I'm not saying that shit happened, okay? I'm not saying that, look, you know, they were moving at night and conditions were low visibility and the radar was defective. They had posted additional watches external to the ship, and then
you're saying if he had done everything right,
right,
something terrible happened.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
But that's
but
not what we're talking
about.
He
didn't do anything right.
He didn't do any.
You know?
And in fact, he contributed to the collision because again, I've transited the Malaccan Straits and gone into Singapore. We were at general quarters on the USS Ranger, a fossil fuel aircraft carrier, in 1987. We were at general quarters going through the Malaccan Straits. The sea and anchor detail, which is the most experienced navigators and helmsmen, were running the ship. Okay, he opted against doing any of that, so he is culpable.
And then stood by,
yeah,
and didn't intervene even when they. Or so this is the part that really kills me is when they were trying. You know, the person at the helm was having trouble managing both, you know, steering and prop control. You know, and the throttle. So they were trying to transfer throttle control to another workstation, ended up transferring both controls, and in the confusion on the bridge, managed to do nothing. They, you know, released a radio transmission saying that they had lost control, but they did not try to communicate with the, what was it, the Olmec, the merchant ship that they ended up colliding with?
Yes.
Did not try to do any bridge-to-bridge communications whatsoever. You know, we're talking about a series of not just failures, but embarrassing failures. We're not talking about mistakes. We're talking about failing in your duties.
And I think anybody who's served aboard ship and has done general quarters drills and things like this, to me, the cherry on top that for these families just must be heart-crushing is, look, you don't know you're going to hit a ship 2 seconds before it happens. Two or 3 minutes out that we're not going to make this. To hit the collision alarm, to put the ship to general quarters, if these sailors had 30 seconds warning, most of them would have been out of the berthing area. You sit up, and you're listening for, this is a drill, general quarters, blah, blah, blah. When you don't hear, this is a drill, and all you hear is that, wah, 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 you grab your shit, and you move like lightning, okay?
Yeah.
And they didn't even do that, and he was on the bridge. And so, to me, the guy on the McCain is uniquely culpable.
I agree. And I'm not trying to dehumanize him or any of the other people who, in my opinion, were responsible for this incident. I understand there's human beings that are capable of mistakes. But the Navy, you know, bringing a little bit of Star Trek into this, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right? The Navy needs to look at this as an opportunity to set a precedent. You know, this could have been when the Navy said, we're drawing a hard line and we're not going to tolerate the unnecessary death of our sailors because people aren't doing their jobs. And instead the Navy said, we're going to parade these guys out in front of you with some cameras so that you can see the illusion of progress, and then we're going to go back to business as usual. It's really what this looked like to me. I hope I'm wrong. But I didn't see anything to come out of the investigation or the subsequent court-martials that indicates that anything's going to be different moving forward. I know there's been a lot of command changeover at PACCOM and at Seventh Fleet, but I still haven't seen anything change. I've just seen different names on the websites. You know, and these court-martials were an opportunity from a PR standpoint. The gears could be turning behind the curtain for big changes that we're not aware of. But these court-martials were a very public opportunity for them to show us that they're taking for the death of these guys, these sailors, guys and girls. There may have been females.
No, there wasn't.
This
all,
was a,
all 17 are male.
This was a chance to show us that the Navy is not going to tolerate people dying for no reason. And instead, they issued letters of reprimand. To me, that's unacceptable. I'm not saying that, you know, and I said this in, you know, talking to the other writers at Safra. I'm not saying that I want Commander Sanchez, I think, yeah, I know, Alfredo Sanchez. I'm not saying I want him to go home and eat his pistol. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that I want the people who are culpable for this tragedy to be held accountable in a way that makes other commanders, that makes other aspiring commanders go, I better not let that happen. And every time someone tells me, yeah, but he's got to live with his guilt, I say, no, that's what we assume and hope of people. That's not an inherent truth for all people. That's not a punishment that sets any precedent. And what I'd really like to see is something different going on in our Navy, because until something different goes on, I have to assume that these risks remain. You know?
You know what? And I, Alex, I agree with you, because to me, what I would have liked to seen at Parris Island, if these guys are culpable, how do you not lose a rank or two?
Yep.
Right? But again, what you said, what are you trying to achieve through this discipline? You're trying to send a message to the institution. Everybody pay attention. Okay? And the sergeant major, he gets busted down. The regimental commander, he's now a major. That's how he's going to retire. Okay? That's how serious we take this shit. Okay? It is going to cost you thousands of dollars every month for the rest of your life. Okay? We're not going to take it all back, but we're going to get into your ass. So guess what? You better have your ass and your brain wired together. You better do your fucking job, because if somebody dies because of your negligence, if you're a leader, you're going to pay. And that falls in line with what we get taught as a leader from day one. You are responsible for everything your unit does or fails to do. And then you see shit like this and you say, well, not very responsible. Again, I cannot even tell you what went through my head. I didn't understand it when I read that a Navy lieutenant who was the officer of the deck on the USS Fitzgerald was NJP'd. That means it was a misdemeanor that killed seven people.
And even this, you know, this negligence conviction that he pled guilty to, it's going to show on his criminal record as a felony misdemeanor. The seven people died. He's going to pay 6 hours and have a felony misdemeanor on his criminal record.
And that's enough.
You know, and what you're telling me then is that small unit leadership, you know, in the Marine Corps, I remember being, you know, a platoon sergeant and being held accountable for the actions of my Marines, whether I was present or not. You know, if they're drunk at the base theater, that is on me. It doesn't matter that I live off base 45 minutes away and I'm hanging out with my wife that night. It's my responsibility that this asshole is drunk at the base theater, even though he's underage. Now, if we want our young enlisted leaders to have that mindset, where you are responsible for your Marines, you better be all over them. How do we not extend that to our commissioned leaders, especially in senior places of authority? You know, you're the commander of an Arleigh Burke-class missile, you know, like missile destroyer. That's a huge responsibility. And when things go the worst that they possibly could, non-combat scenario, there's no legitimate dangers in the vicinity other than just normal shipping traffic that every other vessel is managing to mitigate, you lose sailors on your watch. That's the worst thing you can do.
You own it.
And what we're showing is, yeah, but your punishment is going to be a letter of reprimand. Whereas if you're a corporal, and, you know, one of your Marines dies on your watch,
you're going to the brig.
They're going to throw a book at you. Yeah, you're going to the brig.
Let me just tell you, I think that double standard is total bullshit, okay? And if that gunny goes to jail for 10 years, then what should the guys who could have prevented that, the sergeant majors, the first sergeants, where's the company commander? Did he not get told? Why aren't all of them going to the brig? Because they all contributed.
The difference is that we're seeing the Marine Corps try to make an example of someone versus the Navy just try to parade some stuff in front of us until we stop talking about it.
Right. But again, the Marine Corps, all the commanders, they all skated. He $5,000 to $6,000 fine, and he's allowed to retire as lieutenant colonel. Now that's, I've been told, is going to be reviewed, possibly could be reduced to a major. But what happened? The regimental commander was immunized. Oh, it wasn't his fault? Well, that's a good message to send everybody. So anyway, all right. What are you writing about this week? And tell everybody where to find it.
Well, first off, you can find me on SoftRep.com or on Facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter or on Twitter at AlexHollings52. As for stuff I'm writing about this week, I actually just got done writing up some stuff about that Norwegian anti-ship missile that we're adopting.
Love that.
Because I think it's going to go into the F-35 as well. It's really going to expand our capabilities out there. I've also done a little bit more UFO writing, so if you're looking for alien stuff, by all means. I do recommend, you know, if you go to SoftRep right now, when over on the right-hand side, the top news, that UFO story is at the top. You don't have to read everything I wrote if you don't want to. We talked about it. But you can watch the video testimony of Commander Fravor, who's an intelligent guy, a reliable source, and the things that he describes seeing are crazy. I recommend watching that, if nothing else, just because it's probably the most believable UFO account I've ever seen. So it's worth checking out, you know? And as for the rest of the week, man, you know, the world's always burning. I just pick a direction and write about what I see, so...
All right. Well, Mr. Kim just announced that he was going to meet with Bashar al-Assad. He's the villain in a bad James Bond movie.
Except this is a whirlwind tour for Kim, man. Yeah. He's meeting with Putin, with Xi, with Trump, with Assad. He's created an international leader out of himself.
Well, you know what?
Which is honestly, it was the point. That was always the point, right?
And let me tell you, I don't know if you saw it, but the story in the Washington Post this morning and on the wires that he fired all the senior guys in the military and replaced them with guys that are loyal to him. And that supposedly, it was being written about weeks ago, saying that the presence of these guys puts him in fear for his life. And the direction he wants to take North Korea is not something that they support. They support, you know, the kingdom, which is keep it separate, keep it the way it is, don't change it.
Here it's the tradition.
Yeah, so so it'll be interesting. All right, sir, first of all, thank you very much for the visit this morning. Always a pleasure.
Hey, man, I'm glad to come on anytime you'll have me. Thanks for it.
All right, there you have it. Alex Hollings, senior writer, soft rep, former Marine sergeant. Speaking of sergeants, Mike Musselman, sergeant type, going to join us coming up next. Right here on your home for it. Yeah. The All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Yeah. Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.